Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are at episode 19. Thanks for listening. I thought I'd start today's episode just sharing a little personal note. This podcast should launch on Monday, April 25th, and on Tuesday, April 26th at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I will be defending my dissertation. So please send good vibes. Yeah, long journey coming to a close, hopefully. So hopefully by Tuesday night, I will be Dr. Chris. So that's kind of fun and exciting, and just wanted to share that. So just because I'm going to be glad it's over. So anyway, getting going. So today, on today's episode, we're going to be talking to Dr. Jeffrey Nealon from Penn State University. And I think you're going to find this conversation really fascinating. I did. I first was introduced to the work of Dr. Nealon through, if you're going to train in narrative therapy, you're going to inevitably be introduced to the work of Michel Foucault, or at least I hope you are. And I was early in my training as a therapist, and really, Foucault was, obviously a very interesting person, very profound work, and much of which really resonated with me at the time. I also had it was kind of troubling in some ways, I guess, because I experienced it at the time as kind of being this kind of totalizing description of power, almost deterministic in a way. And so I kind of struggled with the ideas of Foucault and where resistance might lie and that kind of thing. And fortunately, I kind of hung in there, wrestled with the ideas, sought out other readings, and that's where I found Dr. Nealon's book, Foucault Beyond Foucault, which I highly recommend if you have not read it. And it really was helpful to me in kind of providing a new look, a new understanding, kind of a new way of looking at power and resistance, which I found very helpful and continue to find helpful. So ever since then, Dr. Nealon's works has been on my radar. And I think now, in the last few years, I've been really interested in kind of what's happening, this idea. I read a Bruno Latour paper that was in the journal Critical Inquiry. I think it was published in 2004. If you haven't read it, I recommend it. It's called Has Critique Run Out of Steam? And he begins to make the argument about the tools of like post-structuralism, postmodernism being co-opted by the right dangerously, using the example of climate change as one case of where the right is kind of co-opting these tools. And so there was this kind of challenge: are these tools still useful to us in today's contemporary climate, right? And so, or as Dr. Nealon would say, has postmodernism become the house style of capitalism? So, which we will go into more in the conversation. And so, when Dr. Nealon's book when I discovered Dr. Nealon's book, Post-Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Just-in-Time Capitalism, I once again became really, found him very helpful in kind of talking about, these ideas about what's next or where we're headed. And, this idea that he presents of moving from a kind of a hermeneutics of suspicion to a hermeneutics of situation, which we will go into more as well. Which I find, and still am finding, still chewing on and finding very helpful in ways of thinking about with the tools of the present, so to speak. So let's let's talk to Dr. Nealon. But before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Nealon. Dr. Jeffrey Nealon is a liberal arts research professor of English at Penn State University. He is the author of Double Reading, Postmodernism After Deconstruction, Alterity Politics, Ethics and Performative Subjectivity, The Theory Toolbox, Critical Concepts for the New Humanities, and of course, Foucault Beyond Foucault, Power and Its Intensification since 1984, and of course, Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Just-in-Time Capitalism. And most recently, I think in the last couple of months, he's released a new book called Plant Theory, Biopower and Vegetable Life, all of these on Stanford University Press. So look out for those. I think you'll find everything. I haven't read the Plant Theory book, but I'm sure it's fascinating. But I think you'll find these books really helpful. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Jeffrey Nealon. All right. Well, welcome to The Radical Therapist, Dr. Nealon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you had some time. I've been a fan for a little while. I think it's been a few years since I read the first book. It's not your first book, but the first book I read of yours, Foucault Beyond Foucault, and I just really enjoyed that book. And then most recently picked up Postmodernism. And which had a very fascinating title for me too. So I'm really glad to be getting into that as well, because I just think it's an interesting time, an interesting topic, and I think you're kind of on the leading edge of starting to talk about what you're coining as postmodernism. So, but before we get there, let me kind of start with how I first got introduced to you, and I guess I'm going to start kind of maybe talking about the book Foucault Beyond Foucault and kind of your take on Foucault. But I was at an event somewhere and somebody said to me, you know, well, Foucault had never had email. And it was this way of saying, you know, Foucault's important, but, you know, the world's so changed now from, you know, when he was around. Who knows, right? And so I guess my first question to you is really, is Foucault still relevant for our time?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And I understand those sorts of hesitations, right, that everything has to be freshly packaged. But I think at least in the sort of theory world, each generation gets its own version of X, Y, and Z figure, right? So there's a sort of a postmodern Plato, there's a, you know, there's a brand new Augustine, et cetera, et cetera. So I think thinkers remain relevant largely because people keep commenting on them and working them in new and exciting ways. At the same time, I think Foucault is particularly relevant insofar as he just foregrounds the question of power in a way that I think remains relevant, and even my argument is even more so in the present, because it's in the sort of email world of, or you know, screen world of screens, power can very quickly disappear. Right, you just pull it up and there it is. There's the Skype, there's the video, there's the whatever. A lot of machinations happen behind the scenes, or maybe even on the surface, that still remain to be disentangled, it seems to me. And so the question of power and the question of subjectivity, right? It seems to me that in the past 25 years, our subjectivity has become even more on the radar of multinational capital, of you know, who we are has become the only saleable commodity of our time.
Interesting, yeah.
So his focus on identity and on power, it seems to me, make him relevant for the present. Although, I mean, I have to say that there's a certain reading of Foucault that doesn't strike me as being terribly relevant, and that's kind of why I wanted to write the book. If indeed Foucault is the way that, if his work works in the way that people say it, most often say it does, which is to say, use your authentic subjectivity to sort of transgress norms and set yourself free.
Yes.
Then I don't think Foucault is quite as valuable as he might be. So that's for me why I have to kind of reinvent or at least emphasize certain parts of Foucault for the present.
Yeah, and that we're going to get there, and that's I like that critique of yours as well. So especially in today's world, but in the book you take on several criticisms of Foucault, including, I guess, the dominant criticism that Foucault's work and his descriptions of power are kind of a dead end with no possibility for any subjective or collective resistance.
that these descriptions of power are too totalizing, too demoralizing, and if power is everywhere, according to Foucault, how can we account for any resistance or agency? And you really take that. Can you say more about that, how you take that critique on?
Well, yeah, and again, I think that's one of the kind of dominant critiques of the Foucault consensus, this idea that we've moved beyond Foucault precisely because he shows us that power is irresistible, both in the sense that you can't resist it and it sort of sucks you in some way. So there's a sort of a Borg theory of power that there's no point in resisting because it will always co-opt whatever right. you do, et cetera, et cetera. It strikes me that that reading is wrong, but that's not the primary reason why I want to combat it. Even if it's right, then Foucault really isn't of much use to us, right? Because if power is a dead end, or if it co-opts what we do, then in fact, you know, bonjour Foucault. Yeah. But it does seem to me that the question is really what power is, or how power works, right? That power acts on actions. It doesn't act on bodies, or it doesn't act on things. It curtails particular kinds of actions, or makes some actions easier, makes other actions more difficult. Mm. And it seems to me that's the point at which Deleuze says power acts on resistance, right? So resistance comes first, and Foucault will say this in at least one place, and this is sort of Deleuze's slogan for how Foucault's work works. So it always puzzles me when people say there's no resistance in Foucault, or no possibility for resistance, because when you say power is everywhere, you're also saying that resistance is everywhere.
Right.
Right? So this idea that I think what people really mean there is there's no authentic action that's not that's not somehow conditioned by, or at least affected by, dominant power structures. And I think that's true. You're always working with power, that all action is reaction because you're always working within a particular kind of regime.
Yeah, interesting.
Be political or subjective or scientific or institutional, you're always within a particular kind of power structure. So you're always responding. And it's the sort of arts of response that are the arts of power. So again, my sense is that resistance is not a scarce commodity at all in Foucault. In fact, it's all over the place.
Yeah, and you make that point. You say that Foucault has much to teach us about power and resistance, and that saturate our contemporary times. Can you say more about how you see, or how you view resistance in the here and now?
Well, again, it seems to me that there are two versions of this kind of claim, right? There's a more or less philosophical or ontological one, right, which has to do with how power actually works. And again, the power works on what Deleuze would call kind of a virtual level, right? It acts on our actions. It makes certain things easier for us to do. It makes certain things difficult, if not impossible, for us to do. So it doesn't work directly. It doesn't coerce individual bodies. Right. Unlike sovereign power, it doesn't write directly on bodies. Yeah. It works on potentials. Right. So power acts on our potentials to some degree, and that's what makes it more efficient. Right. In the present, or in the disciplinary and the biopolitical world, power works more efficiently because it doesn't have to coerce each individual person to do a particular kind of thing.
Right.
Right. And again, it seems to me over the past 25 years, the kind of emailing and video chatting and, you know, work from home, et cetera, all this is very much more that version of power, right? The power is becoming increasingly disconnected from the individual body and become more a matter of working on our potentials or on our aptitudes or what we can and cannot do.
Right. Right?
So that's why it seems to me that particular ontological description of power gives you purchase on the way that power works in everyday life, right? In other words, that you seem to be getting quote unquote freer, or you more have more access to more things, but that creates its own level of subjection.
Yeah. Now, touching on that point that you brought up earlier, you kind of point out the misread of Foucault's late work, summarized as artistic self-creation as resistance, you argue. That because so much of present-day counterculture has become wholly normative, for example, get a tattoo, normative power will shudder, which I thought was funny, and has morphed into, this has kind of morphed into a kind of a liberal individualism, or endless, what you describe as endless fetishized self-creation. And you argue that rather than performing its totalizing work through cultural standardization or repression, discipline now performs its work through the imperative to become resistant to the government, the man, or the herd, which has a lot to say about the hipsters, right? So, can you say more about that? Yeah.
Well, the hipsters have met the Trump supporters, right?
At
this moment of endless fetishized authentic individuality, right? So in other words, it's become as much the discourse of the right right? When
For sure.
Conservative politicians can brand themselves as anti-Washington mavericks and right people who simply want to be left alone to self-actualize.
Yeah.
Right. That is that's where you meet the bearded Brooklyn hipster meets the meets the Iowa Trump supporter.
Right.
Precisely on this biopolitical terrain of fetishized authentic subjectivity, which again suggests authentic subjectivity, being your own person, throwing off the man or the herd, was an effective means of resisting, say, a version of Fordist capitalism, right? Mm. So in other words, if you're making it new, if you're being your own person, in the heydays of modernism in the 20s and 30s, et cetera, well, you're doing something by definition other than what most other people are doing, because it's a mass production society.
Right.
So if you're doing some kind of retail work, if you're writing poetry in the 20s, you are resistant to the dominant norms of the social system,
right?
Which are Fordist. If you're making it new, you're not making it the same, which is the sort of slogan of Fordism. Mm. So, artistic self-creation is, I think, was a resistance strategy to, dominant modes of the early part of the 20th century. But, fast forward 50 years, and maybe this is the inversion of the email critique, it no longer works that way, right? In other words, the dominant imperatives of our culture are artistic self-creation. It's in fact the only saleable commodity that's out there, right? If you Google authenticity, you'll come up with 50 business hits, yeah. Right? And it's all about branding. It's all about the way you get people to buy Crest rather than Colgate is its authenticity. Or as you say, in sort of hipster markets, right? The coffee markets and the organic produce markets, those are all about authenticity, all about not doing what everybody else does, niche marketing, branding, et cetera, et cetera.
So what's the alternative, I guess, even in my own mind? So.
Well, again, I think it's not so much a matter of that you always have to then outflank capitalism by doing some other kind of thing,
right.
Go off grid, organic farm yourself, mine your own, whatever, because it seems to me that's not, again, this becomes for me why Foucault is important. There is no outside to power,
sure.
Right? So the question is always a jujitsu version of it, how you work with it. And I think one of the things that disappears is this sort of authenticity discourse, precisely because authenticity suggests that resistance resides in a practice, which is to say, which isn't wrong, but if you do yoga, or if you don't eat meat, or if you don't shop at Walmart, then you are performing some version of resistance, and you are sticking it to the man of that strikes me. I have nothing against yoga or vegetarianism or not shopping at Walmart. The question would be how you thematize that as some version of resistance to something. In a micro level way, it may be, but I think oftentimes these things function more as a sort of self-satisfied version of a double down on consumer culture. Right, that I'm not doing something is itself a version of engagement with something.
Yeah.
And again, I have no problem with that to some degree. It's just the claims that people make for it. And at the end of the day, I think one of the targets of all of this is precisely the discourse of authenticity, which at this point strikes me as more trouble than it's worth, right? That we're all implicated with global capital. So the question is not so much, what can I do that's clean, but how much does what I do cost? Right?
Yeah.
And that's the sort of fulcrum I try to pull out of Foucault, right? I mean, what does it cost to do something? Like, what are the sort of, what are the gains and what are the costs of doing X, Y, or Z thing? Rather than, will this thing free me or will it resist in the proper kind of way? That you have to work with where you are. So it's a question of trying to think about the implications of what you're doing down the line somewhere, unintended consequences, et cetera, rather than looking for some, like, if I just go to meditation class, I'll be a better human being or something.
Yeah. And interesting. Yeah. And rather, I like that idea of rather than looking for, because I think it's, you can't get trapped in that looking for the clean rather than just examining the cost. And I enjoyed your jujitsu metaphor too.
So. Well, I think Foucault says it's not, people sort of know what they do or what they should do or what they might do. What they don't know is what they're doing does.
Right.
Which is an odd phrase, but that's because power, again, is virtual, that it works on, right? That's oddly where the action is in a certain kind of virtual question about a futures market. Where does this lead to some degree? And that's an experimental kind of practice and can't really be predicted from before the fact. And you can't know that what you're doing is going to be either, clean or progressive or liberating or such and such authentic.
Yeah, right.
It's not available at the point of entry.
Right. Great. Thank you. Okay, going on. You also in the book took, which was my introduction to it, because my introduction to Foucault was really around the panoptic kind of institutionally based training exercises. And you kind of move beyond that and you start writing about kind of biopower and its attempt to map the increased intensity of present-day biopower, and how, and you argue that contemporary biopower is less interested in regulating behavior through panoptic institutionally based training exercises and is more interested in targeting life and lifestyles. You describe this as power from, and you talked about this, moving from policing the act to policing the norm. I kind of found myself wondering if you have replaced, I found myself wondering if you kind of replaced one totalizing description of power with another, and now that power has become lighter and more intense, attacking our very lives, what are we to do kind of thing?
Well, again, I think Foucault is very bad at offering prescriptions.
Yeah, right, right.
It is a diagnostic discourse, though, right? So you can, someone will have to write your own prescriptions to follow out the medical metaphor. And I think that's, for me, where it's valuable. It's a matter of diagnosing how the present works, or how power works in the present. Mm. So it's not so much, again, that when biopower, so I use this Raymond Williams terminology of dominant, emergent, and residual, right? So it's, or Tom Flynn talks about a triangle of sovereign power, disciplinary power, and biopower. It's not so much that one form of power simply takes over wholesale from another,
yeah, okay,
right? Discipline is now dead and we live in a world of biopower, or even that sovereign power is now dead, right? You only have to watch an ISIS video to see sovereign power on display.
Sure.
Or go to a prison, right, to see disciplinary power on display, or even, you know, the death chamber in the prison to see sovereign power back. Mm-hmm. But the question is, the dominant mode distributes the other ones in a slightly different kind of way, right? So that, take ISIS, for example, you know, there are versions of sovereign power, right? The chopping off of limbs, the murders, largely feed a biopolitical end, right? They want to recruit people to their version of jihad, yeah, to a particular kind of subjectivity, which is oddly enough authentic, right? They have their own version of this kind of thing, right?
Right.
So their biopolitical, so sovereign power still exists, but it's largely, its effects are filtered through biopolitical ends, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And disciplinary power, certainly people still, that we still send our children to school every day for 8 hours,
yeah,
where disciplinary power, panopticism, where they learn various sorts of things about hierarchies and surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, and the schools and universities and police departments remain powerful forces in our society. But again, even if you look at something like the school, the way in which they're primarily taught to be entrepreneurs of themselves at this point, right? Mm. In a way that I'm 52 years old. Like, I was not taught to be an entrepreneur of myself in school, right? I was taught to sit down, shut up, follow orders, and that would set me free.
Me too.
right, yeah. But I mean, my children are largely taught to be sort of homo economicus, right? The man of biopower, the person who develops his or her potential, rather than someone who, if you don't just follow orders, that's not what we need in the biopolitical economy of the future, right? We need people who are innovators, right? So even people
disruptors.
Working at McDonald's, right, disruptors, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, even people who work at McDonald's are disrupting the way you make fries,
right?
Because it's all make it new all the time. And that's the only way to sort of squeeze value out of an increasingly smaller or increasingly same size pie. Yeah. So again, I mean, so discipline still remains in schools, but what's being the more or less quote unquote content of the schools is a change. It's more of a biopolitical sense of identity formation means everything. Right? And again, when I was in school, your identity didn't make any difference.
Yeah, right.
Well, unless you were queer or tall or fat, or like those things made a difference in a negative kind of way.
Yeah, but, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And we're similar in age, so I identify. Right. Okay, so one of the more interesting claims in your book, or at least for me, was this idea, and I thought this was like really interesting, this idea of proclaiming resistance is everywhere is more damaging than proclaiming domination is everywhere. Because if people are freer than they think they are and do not need to be shown the way out of the jobs of pointing out oppression or giving voice to the people or guiding oppressed towards freedom would no longer be secure. Can you say more about that? And I guess my follow-up question, that was that kind of pointed at the academy, or is it pointed kind of everywhere, even in maybe therapy or something like that?
Well, yeah, I'd certainly like to hear more about how Foucault circulates in therapy these days.
Yeah.
But it's to some degree pointed at the academy, but I think also just this general sense of what's the interview? Intellectuals in Power. It's this interview between with Foucault, Deleuze, and some Maoist students, probably 1971, 72. Mm. And it's the one that Gayatri Spivak picks up on in her Can the Subaltern Speak? Right, and they're both Foucault and Deleuze say, you know, the number one thing they want to avoid is speaking for people, the indignity of speaking for others. Foucault says at some point, you know, oppressed people know perfectly well what's happening to them. The question is, how can their versions of resistance link up to other kinds of struggles? Right, how can it be effective? They don't need to be told that they're being oppressed; they know that.
Right. Right?
So the questions end up elsewhere, and the question of voice is not. Not really primarily the question, representation, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what Spivak picks up on and says, well, no. The global poor or the national poor need a voice. They need other people to step in for them, to speak for them, to represent their interests because they don't quite know. They may not understand fully the predicament they're in, et cetera, et cetera. And I think either one of the, you know, I don't have any particular beef with that as an idea, but certainly Foucault and Deleuze do. Yeah. Which is to say that, you know, people don't need to be shown the way. They need to have a place where their desire can connect to the socials in some sort of effective way. They don't need to be told how bad they have to feel. And that at the end of the day, this is the sort of primary claim that Foucault, Deleuze, other sorts of people make that tends to irritate people on the ideology end of the spectrum, is that people, it's not a matter that people are duped, right? They're not fooled. Showing people how things work or telling them the truth will not set them free.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
right. And again, you can see that, you know, people tend to wring their hands about the death of investigative journalism, or you know that the news has become entertainment. But you can do exposés all day long on the truth behind something, and it seems right that neither Bernie's nor Trump's policies are necessarily viable. That doesn't make any difference to the Bernie or Trump supporters, right, on the left or on the right, because they're supporting something else, really.
Right. Right.
They're not supporting the truth of the issue. They're supporting a kind of a biopolitical revolution.
Right. And maybe in that theme, in the book, you believe the question we should be concerned with is not how to mine and recover resistance from totalized power, but how to mobilize, focus, or intensify these practices of resistance that you describe as already in place, right? And so, and maybe that linking, I'm thinking that how do you link what they're doing to, I don't know how you would characterize it, but in the book you argue this effort can best be accomplished by what Foucault called subjugated knowledges or knowledges from below. And can you describe like some of these knowledge, kind of say more about that or how you recognize that in these times?
Well, yeah, I think if you look at the kind of, you know, even the dominant identity movements of our time, having to say queer theory or, you know, and I'm sure various sorts of psychiatric revolutions, they don't come from the top down. You know, the American Psychiatric Association recognizes something and then all of a sudden the world agrees with them because they're experts, right?
Right.
Experts don't really, if you bring an expert onto TV, that's it for the issue. Yeah. Right. That change doesn't happen in a top-down way. It's tempting to think it does, that it happens from the sort of the institutions of power who decide to become accepting of queer people, for example. Yeah. Absolutely not. It happens the other way around. Right.
Right.
It happens through certain kinds of biopolitical revolutions, which is to say queer people have benefited from the very argument that was used to beat them a generation ago, that they're just that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But biopolitically speaking, that's in a world where identity is really the only thing that matters. That becomes a powerful kind of argument. It's like, you know what? That's their identity, and we have to respect that, right? But that happens from the ground up, and it happens to Dick Cheney's daughter, and right. It happens in this sort of retail rather than wholesale way. Change doesn't seem to me occur from the top down, from edicts of various kinds, or from the experts, but it occurs incrementally in small sorts of transversal operations where, you know, everybody knows somebody who's queer now, and everybody many people have been to a wedding. And again, there's a backlash there as well, and other kinds of places that, you know, want their own bathrooms or don't want to make cakes for queer weddings. Those sorts of things are predictable. But, you know, the on the side of history is precisely this movement, right? Which maybe started at Stonewall, and one can write different kinds of histories of it. But it's not a top-down movement, right? It's the subjugated knowledge of, you know, the experience of being queer and how that has to be taken seriously and how it has to be mobilized across American life rather than simply tolerated in some way. And I think that's, at some level, the way change happens in a Foucauldian, right? It happens more like a contagion or something like it, rather than this kind of top-down imposed, right? You have to, it's changing practices, not changing minds, I think, is at the end of the day.
Like, okay. Yeah, which leads to kind of a question I have, maybe to ask you what your take is on this, is like some of maybe these larger oppositional movements like Occupy or the Arab Spring, and that kind of started with a bang and then kind of went away. And I'm wondering if, you know, maybe is there something they're getting wrong in an age of biopower, or will it come back, or what do you think of these kinds of movements and their effectiveness?
Well, I think, you know, a couple different things one could say about them, right? One, that they are symptomatic of this kind of retail rather than wholesale, but things pop up in particular kinds of ways and they catch fire or they don't. Right. Certainly the Arab Spring catches fire, but runs into various firewalls in other parts of the Arab world. Right. Occupy has its sort of moment on the stage, but doesn't necessarily work itself out in terms of a larger institutional kind of movement. But I'm not sure that's really what it wanted to begin with. Right. The thing that struck me as kind of odd about Occupy, and I don't know as much about it as I might, but the way in which it was so parliamentary, there were so many rules involved in it, like who could speak and when, and, you know, trying, I think, to get out of the indignity of speaking for people. But it does seem to me that there's this real desire for rules among many of the sort of young activist types that I see on campus and other, like, demanding more training and this and that. And these are oftentimes among the demands that people make when they take over buildings. They want more sensitivity training. They want more psychiatric power in a weird way. And one wonders about that, I think. I don't have anything in particular to say about it, but it seems from a Foucauldian point of view, it's a bizarre thing to want more of.
Interesting. Like,
if you want more of anything else, I'm not sure why you'd want more, but people seem to want more discipline.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Okay, so let's kind of transition to the new book, which is titled Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Just-in-Time Capitalism. And I guess my first question to you is, why postmodernism?
Well, that's nested in Frederick Jameson's 1991 book, which is called Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism.
Right.
And late capitalism is always one of those phrases that seems to harbor a certain kind of hope that, you know, capitalism will be over soon enough. and there's very little evidence of that over the past 20 years. So the pun in just in time, I mean, it could be called neoliberal capitalism. It could be called, you know, a number of other things, that globalized capitalism. But the sense that capitalism tends to go from being late to being just, it arrives just when it needs to, that it's very light, very nimble, and that our strategies for thinking about it oftentimes remain in that kind of more disciplinary world of transgression or authenticity, et cetera, right? So I'm just, for me, the Foucault book began as the theoretical introduction to this post-post book, but it got too long and it sort of became, it was all about Foucault. Yeah. So it just became its own kind of project. But it's really more a matter of trying to think about capitalism also as this, you know, highly, highly virtual entity. And the capitalism's, essentially the operating system of capital, of neoliberal capitalism is biopower. Some level of the claim that the two books would cash out would be that if you sort of understand something about biopower, the importance of identity as a category, a financial category, then you understand something about how late capitalism or postmodern capitalism or globalized capitalism work. It's in the identity business. It sells identities. It doesn't sell anything else.
Yeah. And that,
go ahead.
Yeah, that was my take. I thought in the read that you were really expanding on this idea of like, that kind of artistic self-creation fed is, you know, that how that's kind of playing out now in just-in-time capitalism or neoliberal capitalism or what have you. So, but in the book, you argue that post-postmodernism is best understood as a historical period of capitalistic development rather than understanding it as a, and this was interesting to me, rather than understanding it as a style of artistic practice
a movement within various art and architecture discourse, or even a kind of zeitgeist, which is, I think, where a lot of, you know, there's a postmodern thought, for example, is situated, but this seems like quite a shift. You're really looking at it from a capitalistic perspective. Can you say more about that?
Well, yeah, I think the kind of stylistics or the zeitgeist stuff is, whether it likes it or not, already related to capitalism, right? So in other words, say just in terms of something like literature, if you take people like Pynchon or John Barth or the sort of high postmodern, you know, so there's all this reflexivity, fragmentation, calls attention to itself in some way. Mm. You know, the things we tend to think of stylistically as being postmodern, being ironic, non-totalizing, open-ended endings, things like this. Mm. That's related, I think, to a moment of the last moments of Fordist capitalism, right? So that work speaks to people in a particular kind of way, precisely because there's still this sort of totalized world of disciplinary capitalism. Stay in your box, do your job, right? So this transgression, all this stuff makes sense as a sort of as an avant-gardist strategy. But again, fast forward 30, 40 years, that's the way capitalism works, right? To some degree, you know, postmodernism of that ironic, juxtaposed, fragmented, always moving, open-ended, excessive, like that's the Goldman Sachs plan.
Yeah,
right. That's how derivatives work, or something like it. So at some level, the stylistics of postmodernism were always already about a certain kind of capitalism. It just didn't seem that way to people.
Right.
And I think if postmodernism now is sort of petering out as a stylistic movement, and people are sort of talking about, you know, the new sincerity or post-postmodernism or meta-modernism or whatever the phrase.
The return of sentimentality.
Well, right, or even the return of various sorts of, certainly in the theory business, the biggest movement of the past 10 or 15 years has been returned to certain kinds of realisms, right? Speculative realism, actor network theory,
I'm a Latour guy, yeah.
Yeah, but only a few years ago. I mean, well, that you know has critique run out of steam, right? That was an important essay for that, for the return of a certain kind of realism, right?
Right.
Karen Barad, the people, everyone from physics to feminism to, right, wants a little piece of the real now, and I think that also has everything to do with capitalism, right? Mm. As the kind of fragmented postmodern style has become the house style of corporations. This return to realism, I think, has a certain kind of utopian belief that if you threw a brick into the superhighway of capital, that might disrupt it, right? A really real, a thing that can't be repackaged, can't be ironically segmented, et cetera,
co-opted.
I mean, I think it's, I wonder about, and it plays in different ways in different periods, I think. But certainly that has been, for me, the most remarkable set of emergences, right? This sort of the sense of the real, like when I was in graduate school, right? It would be brand essentialist, right? That was the thing you did not want to be called. Circa 1989 was an essentialist.
Yeah.
But the new realisms are all essentialisms, right? They're all, this is the way things actually are.
Yeah. So what is your, cause I kind of moved through the art world too, and speculative realism is getting popped up in there a lot. And what do you think that's kind of, this new movement is kind of a dead end or troubling in some ways, or?
Well, no, I think it's interesting. I mean, again, for me, as a Foucauldian, the question is not, is realism, which is to say, you know, much of it, you know, from the sort of Graham Harman style forward, this idea, and a lot of it sort of dreaming of scientific, sort of like the idea that the universe has laws, and those laws were in play long before we showed up or evolved as a species, right? So hence this idea that the universe is what we think about it is incorrect. Well, that also strikes me as true. That's absolutely true. Now, you know, calling that the real and suggesting, and it's related, I think, to various kinds of posthumanisms, to everything from animal studies to affect theory, right? Yep. That human is always a response to something rather than driving the bus. Mm. And that if we thought we were driving the bus, we're driving the bus right off the cliff in terms of environmental disaster, et cetera, et cetera. So I think all these things sort of coalesce around this kind of, let's take the human down a peg or two. And even post-structuralist theory was all about that from the very beginning. Mm. But it does seem to me that this desire to be right about something, as a Foucauldian, does strike me as kind of a dead end, right? The question isn't whether there are as many truths as you can produce, and truth is a political question, right? Mm-hmm. At least in terms of the human. So it's always strange to me, if it's an attempt to take the human down, like what does the tulip or the bacterium or the napkin dispenser care for the truth of things, the way things really are. Right? That only matters to us, right? It doesn't matter to the plants or the
right.
So it seems this odd, and especially in speculative realism, right? There's the sort of four original Beatles of speculative realism, who are who? Harmon, Mayesu, Hamilton, and Brassier. Whoever they are. And you know, then there's everybody picks their favorite Beatle, and then there's some spin-off bands, and Ian Bogost gets to be, you know, the fifth Beatle or something. I don't know. but it does strike me as an odd kind of coterie game, which I'd be, you know, I'd be interested to see how it makes its way into the art world. And people want it to be something, but it doesn't, the strong anti-humanist, like, again, what does art matter to the,
Well, I think it's all in that return to skill or return to beauty or these kinds of things. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think Harmon's got that whole thing about, it's the sort of the aesthetics that the fire doesn't burn the cotton. It transforms it in some way. And that's an aesthetic process or an ethical one. That seems, you know, plausible enough to me. That aesthetics are real. They're not just human. That also strikes me as a plausible kind of argument. Sure. But again, for me, the question, the Foucauldian question is like, why do these things return at this particular moment? And this seems to me that the answer there has everything to do with capitalism, but nobody in that business talks about capitalism at all. At least not to my knowledge.
Well, I think Latour does. I think he...
Well, Latour, yeah, but Latour is a difference. I mean, I'm talking in the, like, if you read the Bogost book, what's it called? Alien Phenomenology. Yeah. It's a 50, it's a 100-page list of stuff. Right. And again, so and the Galloway takedown, Alexander Galloway wrote a book, wrote an essay called Postfordism and Postindustrialism, which makes some pretty serious claims about, well, if you're talking about things and the disconnected quality of things, that plays right up the gut of your neoliberal capitalism. Right. There's nothing but things in the world.
Right.
And they're sort of disjointed in some particular kind of way, and don't, you know, the human political decisions are less important than these things. Like, all that stuff has potentially disturbing outcomes in terms of thinking about change in the world or distribution of wealth or et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, certainly Latour is more on that than I think the kind of more philosophical end of the speculative realism game. That's more a matter of just trying to get back to a really, really old-fashioned sense of ontology, right? Which is to say it's important to be right about something.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a ton of questions that I'm going to try to hold off. So in the new book, Postmodernism, you make a call for a new theoretical and methodological toolbook for responding to the postmodern culture. And so I'm wondering, how do these new theories look, and what are these new methodologies you are pointing to?
Well, yeah, I think the phrase that I use there is sort of, which I steal from, Chris Nealon, who's not related to me, but only if he were, is this phrase, the hermeneutics of situation, from the hermeneutics of suspicion.
Right.
So the hermeneutics of suspicion was the way in which big theory came into the, at least into the sort of literature and philosophy departments, right? That there's something, there's multiple meanings buried behind or within any particular sort of totalized version of meaning, and that the hermeneutics of suspicion would try to tease out those other alternative meanings so as to blow up the very idea of totalization and to show that the world or that lives or that the universe is really multiple, it's not singular, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So this sort of suspicion, it's all about depth or something like that, right? Trying to sort of call something out of what looks like a decided question. And again, I think the new realisms of various kinds really tend to eschew that practice, for a whole series of reasons that we could talk about, but it does seem to me that the hermeneutics of situation is a different kind of thing, which is to say, reading less for meaning or multiple meanings or trying to explode singular meanings or release multiplicities of meaning making, and look more at social situations, like what do these texts tell us about the situation. Right, so you can read some lines from Milton and you can talk about what they mean or what the biblical allusions are or what the allusions to other writers are or how he's remaking the Sestina or whatever. Or you can talk about what do these lines have to do with, you know, with the emergence of early modern capitalism or the emergence of sovereign power or religion or, right? Which is to say, look more about the situation, less inside the text, and trying to sort of blow up what it means, and more outside the text, what is it connected to, or what are other ways it can be connected to other sorts of movements.
So what is it a response to in some ways? Or?
What's it responding to? How is it trying to imagine the future? Or how is it, you know, what are its valences in terms of of politics or religion, or I mean, they're just asking questions that are not primarily formalist questions about meaning. Because I think the terrain of meaning was the terrain of big theory, right? Trying to sort of subvert, remake, show meaning to be multiple, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I think deconstruction more or less, because it succeeded, more or less killed that operation, which is to say, I think at this point, everyone agrees that texts have support multiple meanings.
Right, right.
Perfectly plausible. Some of them even opposite. Right.
Right.
So the question is, what else are you going to do with texts once that kind of meaning operation more or less gets in the groundwater? I don't think, in terms of deconstruction, I don't think it got overcome. I think it sort of became the cultural dominant. Right. I think at this point, people agree that things can be endlessly recontextualized.
Right.
That's true. So what do we do? I think at that point, the terrain of meaning gets evacuated as an interesting research question. Mm-hmm. And you have to start asking different kinds of questions about what something like, what can literature or philosophy do if it doesn't simply constantly expose the multiplicity of meaning?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting question. You raised deconstruction, which I was really interested in talking to you about. You have a chapter in the new book, kind of on deconstruction or post-deconstruction, and you make the argument that it's still valuable and still useful. And I guess, can you say more about that, how you're viewing deconstruction in contemporary times?
Well, I think, again, every era reinvents its figures. Yeah. To some degree. So there's at present, there's a sort of a beef going on in the Derrida world. Jeff Bennington wrote a pretty scathing review of the reissue of Gayatri Spivak's Of Grammatology, which is a fight about among Derrida translators, which is, it's in the LA Review of Books though. So and it's a bit mean-spirited back and forth. Point there being that he wants to suggest that Grammatology was never really a book about language or about writing or about that it was prime, you know, or that language and writing were figures for these non-linguistic operations. I only bring this up because it's an attempt to rebrand. If you asked anybody in 1980 what Of Grammatology was about, they would say it's about writing. It's about language. It's about how language is the skeleton key to understanding everything else.
Right.
Right. So and that may or may not have been correct at the time. But certainly now there's this push to, because Derrida is sort of thought of as the thinker who said there's nothing outside the text, and that means everything works according to the logic of textuality, that it's all about meaning and signs and deferral, that you'd have to reinvent Derrida for this quote unquote realist world. Right. Where language is no longer the kind of the thing that everyone agrees mediates everything else, primarily because that's anthropomorphic, and it's probably just wrong. But so, A, there's a sort of a reinvention of Derrida around the trace, around his work on animals especially, right? That work is now much more important to people probably than the work on writing. And the work on politics, the work on autoimmunity as this sort of question of terrorism, like all that stuff, I think has sort of come to the foreground, and the work on language has been sort of backgrounded to some degree. Mm. And again, the argument I make in the book really is really comes out of more or less out of Antonio Negri's work. Negri says, that in a Fordist world, which is what deconstruction comes out of, right? That kind of mid-60s world.
Yep.
In Europe, caught between Russian totalitarianism on one side and American style capitalism on the other, it tried to make a third way, right? So it's no longer the sign or the signifier, but some sort of third way through, and that was the sort of native turf of deconstruction, right? Trying to show that there were other ways of doing things opposed from these binary schemes,
right?
And it did transgressive work in its time, but the thing is, because it triumphed, right? It's no longer an exit from where we are, but it does name the logic of where we are. Right. So it becomes a different, it goes from being an emergent phenomenon to being a more or less dominant one. That deconstruction is the logic of late capitalism.
Right. Well, Latour argues in that, has critique less esteem, that now the right is using deconstruction in its argument against climate change and that kind of thing. So,
well, right. And again, that's, I think, one of the sorts of desires of people to move, what do they say in the end of the Bush era, reality-based politics, right? That people are just... And the Latour essay was written long before the Iraq War was probably the great, or the second Iraq War, or the third, depending on how you count them, was the great, fabulation war, yeah. Right, where the entire thing was. And again, I think that's part of the reason why people, the solace of the real, right? People who 20 years ago, right, would have called someone like Darwin a misogynist, a racist, right, are now touting evolution as the, right, as the really real. They put the bumper stickers on their Prius.
Yeah.
Right? But because creationism is now the enemy, right? And it's a full blown postmodern textual phenomena that creates a whole world out of a handful of things that no one takes seriously. But right. And again, so I see it's a reaction against that sort of that postmodernism has become the house style of everyone, both on the left and on the right.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of an unhappiness with it.
The house style, I like that. Okay. So in the book, you kind of say that you're less interested in the next big thing when it comes to theory, and you're more interested in what?
Well, I'm sort of interested in what theory can do. That's always been the question for me. It's not so much a matter of being, again, but right about stuff, right? So these sorts of skirmishes about who's got the correct reading of X, Y, or Z person have never stricken me as being particularly compelling.
Okay.
They're just country club fights about who's going to be right. Who's going to be the number one golfer?
Right.
The question is always a matter of what they can do. So again, I think Foucault, even if that sort of dead end reading of Foucault, if the creative self-creation artistically reading of Foucault is correct, then I think Foucault is not of much use to us. Right.
Right.
Same thing with Deleuze. If Deleuze and Guattari come down to just deterritorialize everything and you'll be fine, well, then they're not really of much use to us because, again, that's the house slogan of capitalism
at this point.
So there's got to be something else going on in Foucault or in Deleuze or in whomever to make them useful. So it's always, the question of rereading them is always to sort of to figure out what's useful and, you know, what's living and what's dead in the old Marxist sense.
Yeah.
In all these thinkers. So it's not for me, the professionalism of it is not particularly interesting, like being a professional deconstructionist or being a professional Foucauldian or something. It doesn't seem, it seems like small beer to me compared to trying to sort of, and again, and for students as well, I think that the thing for theory, you know, so I wrote a textbook a number of years ago and it's called the Theory Toolbox. And it's like, you know, theories, toolboxes don't tell you what to build.
Right.
You have to come up with that yourself. It has to be sort of a knowledge from below. You have to need particular tools to think about particular kinds of things. And I think that's what theory is good for. Right. It's not, but I think a lot of people still think of it, A, as a profession, and B, as a series of increasingly complicated methods by which you can produce a reading of something.
Hmm.
Right. So here's a new historicist reading, or here's a feminist reading, or here's a deconstructive reading, or that always struck me as being limiting at best. So for me, the stakes have always been, you know, what can this thing do? Not so much, you know, how can I climb the ladder of this thing?
So do you find, what's your thoughts about epistemology then in this hybrid world that we're in now? I mean, is it useful or do you feel it's, I mean, is it, those walls of epistemology, are they still useful or is there a blending that can happen in epistemology now in this hybrid world? Or how are you thinking about that these days?
Well, yeah, it's never been clear to me what the, you know, if epistemology is a theory of knowledge, and ontology is what the theory of things, the of logos, the mediation of things, and, you know, politics is like the separations of these things never made much sense to me because, again, the point in a kind of a hermeneutics of situation, every era gets the epistemology that it needs.
Yeah.
Right? That's right. So the idea that you can separate a theory of knowledge from like a sort of a meta theory of the way things are, and you can separate both of those from a political theory, that strikes me as being difficult at best and probably just delusional at worst.
Interesting.
So from my point of view, epistemology is social theory, right? Yeah. It has to be. So the question is, you know, again, around something like speculative realism or actor network theory or distant reading or, you know, whatever, you know, why does this come on the scene at a particular political moment becomes an interesting question to me, rather than is this a correct expression of the way things really are?
Mm-hmm.
Which is either an epistemological question or an ontological one, that's where I get confused. When you say this is the way things are, and I guess a lot of the kind of speculative realism stuff is an attempt to end run all the way around epistemology, right? Because epistemology, I presume, is tethered to the subject in this Kantian way, right? So how do I know what I know?
Exactly, yeah.
Becomes the question. So I suspect the fleeing to ontology is an attempt to get back behind the questions of epistemology. And or the questions of politics because they seem too subject-centered. But I would think, it seems to me there's kind of a pottery barn problem here, right? that in the Anthropocene, like, we broke the thing and now we're fleeing desperately from politics and anthropomorphism when, you know, at some level how to fix the thing would seem to be also close to question one.
Yeah, right. Or located, yeah.
Might be the wrong time to abandon subjectivity completely.
Okay. Well, how's your, how are your students? I know, you know, I don't know if I they'll know when I introduce you, but you teach at Penn State. And how are they thinking about theory these days? Just on my own curiosity, how are they using it? Or how do you, is there any hopefulness of how they might use it moving forward? Or?
Well, yeah, I think part of the anti-hermeneutic thing has certainly caught up to even K through 12 curricula. So I teach in an English department and some in philosophy. Mm-hmm. But just the way that even in the K through 12 context, the way people talk about literature, they very seldom talk about it in any kind of formal terms, which is to say in terms of what it means or how it produces certain kinds of meanings or juxtapositions, or they now talk about it almost predominantly in sorts of social, or which is to say that literature is used to sort of, this is what it's like to be an other, right? So To Kill a Mockingbird, or you know, The House on Mango Street, or it's largely part of a multicultural operation of trying to sort of show different points of view, or what it feels like to be queer, what it feels like to be Latino or some. And again, I have no beef with that at all. Mm-hmm. That was not the way that literature was taught to me when I was in grade school, right? Mm-hmm. When they show up from grade school, they don't have really the sort of formalist tools that I used to spend all my time taking away from them. Right? The sort of new critical stuff about universal themes and mood and motivation, all this sort of totalizing stuff that the poem has to have organic unity and has to mean one thing, right? You used to have to fight with people about that. Now you don't have to fight with them about that. You do have to wonder whether Heart of Darkness actually transparently represents what Joseph Conrad thinks about race, because I'm not sure it does, right? There's a narrator there, a guy named Marlowe, who's talking most of that book, who says variously scandalous and somewhat sensitive things about Africa and Africans, and you're supposed to sort of sort that out. But the idea that you could get from there to what Joseph Conrad thinks about race would strike me as formalistically a difficult thing to do, right? So you end up with different kinds of jobs, right? Different kinds of, like, what the situation of colonialism is, and whether simply denouncing racism and colonialism as bad has done any work at the end of the day. I would seriously wonder about that. Or that you can transparently know what it's like to be Asian American by reading an Amy Tan novel or something like that. That would also strike me as being, which isn't exactly what people are doing, but that's the danger of it anyway, I would think, that the job has changed. It's less trying to talk people out of the idea that poems or objects in the world contain some sort of singular meaning, and it's more about, you know, trying to get them suspicious about the way feelings circulate and the idea that those sorts of things can be easily consumed, or that they're not, you know, the affect isn't a harder nub than just, oh, so that's what it's like to be X.
So you're really interested in the work to be done in theory.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to be useful for people. And I think, I think in general, the world isn't getting any less complicated.
No, right.
I think, and it's becoming increasingly more virtual. And the sort of processes by which things are connected are becoming increasingly buried. They're harder to see. And, you know, security, privacy concerns, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think there's a horizon for, you know, for theory there, right? But again, this idea that theory is over because the world has become more complicated, or that theory is too complicated, but the world has become more complicated, but somehow we can get rid of theory because it's too complicated, right? The arguments oftentimes don't make any sense to me, right? Derrida's too hard to read, so.
Right.
Right. Not that hard to read, but you just have to learn how to read it. Right. So yeah, it would seem to me that the difficulty factor is one of the things that recommends theory going forward, right? That it's a language that's worth learning how to speak. I think because if at this point dedication to simplicity, or that's just the way things are, man, that way does not lie.
No, in our complex and increasingly complicated world.
Yeah.
Okay, one final question for you. What's your next book going to be about?
Well, there's a book in the meantime, which was out maybe a few months ago, called Plant Theory. It's about biopower and vegetable life, of all things. Okay. It's largely, animal studies has become a huge thing in the humanities.
I've noticed, yeah.
Probably doesn't play quite as well in psychiatric games, but I would imagine sooner or later people will bring their pets in for analysis.
Yeah, you're seeing more and more, right?
Be ready for that.
Yeah, right.
So, and it, at some level, the animal figures as a kind of an other. If biopower means the sort of complete totalization of totalization, probably the wrong word, territorialization of things onto the human subject, right? Everything has to go through the human subject in order for it to be valuable to some degree in biopower. But the animal can figure as the other of biopower, right? At least that seemed to me like the claim one often sees in animal studies. But rereading Foucault on the question, there's a sort of a long section of The Order of Things where he talks about the way in which, you know, infamously in The Order of Things, he says life did not exist until the beginning of the 19th century, which is similar to other things he says about authors didn't exist before the early modern period, or that homosexuality didn't exist until 1870, right? He makes these sorts of claims often. Point there being something, the object is created by the discourse.
Right.
Biology creates the discourse of life, this thing called life. Life as a sort of as a subtending thing that connects all living things, right? That prior to that point, life was thought more in a naturalistic sense, right? That you could just, things were grouped, animals or plants were grouped by what they looked like, by the surface of their being. With the birth of biology, right, and this increases when you discover cells, other kinds of things, life becomes this kind of hidden secret inside things. Fast forward anyway, the animal becomes increasingly important then for the way to understand life itself, right? Animality is wild, discontinuous, mendacious. It's that little thing inside us that draws us. It's desire itself, right? Which is to say that for Foucault, the animal isn't jettisoned at the birth of biopower in the 19th century. It's fully incorporated into the human as the figure for life itself, right? Hegel, life is desire. Nietzsche, right? The sort of life of overcoming. Darwin, right? There's either natural or sexual selection, right? There's this desire. You know, Freud, reality and its discontents, right? There's this idea that we're driven by something that we're not in control of, right. And that's what makes us human. Right. So I mean, there's that. There's a chapter on Foucault, which is about that. There's a chapter on Derrida, which is about plant life in Derrida. And he has a lot of work on animality, but trying to sort of think about plants in Derrida, mostly about Gla, which is a book that people don't read anymore. And a long section trying to reread Deleuze and Guattari on the rhizome.
Well, okay. Yeah, very. Okay. I'm going to have to check that one out. So, all right, Dr. Nealon, a really fascinating conversation. I love these kinds of conversations, and I really appreciate you taking the time to have it with me. And if our listeners want to reach out to you and about something you might have said or have questions for you, is there a way that they can do that? Or
yeah, I'm easy to find on the web.
Okay. And I'll actually, for all the listeners, I'll have links on the show notes as always, so where you can find him. So just once again, Dr. Nealon, I really thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
No, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening as always. You can reach out to us, please, and please do. We have an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We're on Facebook at The Radical Therapist. We're on Instagram at The Radical Therapist, and on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. So plenty of ways to reach out and kind of let us know how we're doing, what you think of the show, that kind of thing. And also, I still have stickers, plenty of stickers. If you'd like some Radical Therapist stickers sent to you, I would be happy to do that. Just shoot me an email with your address, and I will get those out to you right away. And I think I might have some, I think I might be moving to t-shirts too. So if you're interested in doing a t-shirt, send me an email and let me gauge interest on Radical Therapist t-shirts. So that would be appreciated. So anyway, this has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. My name is Chris Hoff. Thanks for listening.